today's episode of Backpacker Radio, Sean sits down with famed PCT trail angels Scout and Frodo. We learn about Scout's new book, The Continental Divide Trail, Exploring America's Ridgeline Trail, his passion for writing, and we learn about the first person to hike the Continental Divide. We also cover the most popular tents used by 2018 Appalachian Trail thru-hikers and get into a new segment, Forgotten Internet Holidays. But first, here are some ads. If you've listened to Backpacker Radio, you know that both Chance and I are fans of Gossamer Gear, manufacturers of lightweight backpacking gear and accessories. Their packs carry comfortably, their roomy shelters protect in harsh weather conditions, and the trekking poles are some of the lightest on the planet. Gossamer Gear is changing the perception of delicate ultralight gear. Chance and I are both very familiar with Gossamer Gear's products. I used the Gorilla, their 40-liter pack, on the PCT in 2017. Chance used Gossamer Gear's The One Shelter. It's the one you need, after all. Also, to celebrate being in business for 20 years, Gossamer Gear recently put together an awesome short video highlighting their history. It's definitely worth checking out, and we will, of course, link to it in the show notes.
But wait, there's more!
Listeners of this podcast can score an exclusive deal on Gossamer Gear products. Use discount code TREK15 for 15% off your cart at gossamergear.com, which is valid for a limited time only. Get on it. And of course, we want to give a shout out to Sawyer Products. We've talked about the Sawyer Micro enough. Today, I want to remind you guys about their permethrin fabric treatment, which is highly effective against deer ticks. This is important because Lyme disease sucks shit. Sawyer's permethrin treatment is an odorless after-drying fabric treatment that does not harm any fabrics or finishes. It repels and kills mosquitoes and ticks for 6 weeks or 6 washes. It can be used to treat clothing, footwear, workwear, bibs, canvases, workstations, seat covers, dog beds, hammocks, chairs, tents, camping gear, mosquito netting, nets outside of sleeping bags, backpacks, ground cloths, and other fabrics. Hang up clothes or gear, apply enough to spray to allow color change in fabric, allow to dry for 2 hours before use to maximize the insect repellent's effectiveness and longevity. It can also be applied directly to dogs for protection from mosquitoes and fleas for 35 days and from ticks for 6 weeks. Official application instructions can be found at sawyer.com/dogs. You can find Sawyer's permethrin fabric treatment at your local outfitter, REI, or sawyer.com. Okay, let's do this. To the show. Radio presented by the Trek. I am your co-host, Zach Badger Davis, and to my right is...
Hello, I'm Juliana Chauncey, a.k.a. Chance.
Before we get into today's awesome interview with Scout and Frodo, I'm actually just assuming that it's awesome. I haven't heard it.
Oh, it's so good.
It's so good. Do you want to drop in a fun fact for you guys? Today's fun fact comes from the PCT. The previous one was from the AT. That the PCT passes by the three deepest lakes in the United States, and they are Lake Tahoe, Crater Lake, which is actually the deepest lake in the United States, and Lake Chelan. Chelan?
I don't know how you say that.
Fuck, now my ignorance is showing. In Washington, but that was the shallowest of the three deepest lakes.
So who cares?
Yeah, that's exactly right. No one cares about bronze. But yeah, let's not beat around the bush. Let's get right to today's interview with famed trail angels Scout and Frodo.
Today we're sitting down with Barney Mann and Sandy Mann, more commonly referred to as Scout and Frodo, two of the biggest trail angels on the Pacific Crest Trail. Scout authored the Pacific Crest Trail, Exploring America's Wilderness Trail, and is now on his book tour for his newest book, The Continental Divide Trail, Exploring America's Ridgeline Trail. Frodo joined us for a segment on episode 10 back in the spring, and Scout is here for the first time, so welcome and welcome back.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure to be on.
Before we get into the new book, you guys just got back from a trip to Nepal. Can you tell us about that?
Well, she should start, but I'm going to anyway. When I got back, finishing my Triple Crown, PCT, CDT, and AT, people asked me, so Scout, what are you going to do next? And here was my answer, whatever she wants. And that's your introduction to Nepal.
It was a good answer. It was a very dear answer. So this has been on my bucket list for a long time. It's been number one. I had these fantasies of beautiful, big, tall mountains and easy hiking. And it was quite different from that. The mountains were great. But this was a really tough trek. We went to Everest Base Camp. We went over Chola Pass. So it was a little bit of a, in terms of shape, it was kind of like a lollipop.
We were 21 days in country.
Right.
21 days largely above 10,000 feet. We slept, you know, Mount Whitney. Mm-hmm. Mount Whitney is 14.5. We slept above 15,000 feet 6-7 nights in a row. We slept at 17,000 feet.
Yeah.
You are. I'm sitting here now Rocky Mountain High Country here.
Yeah.
There is a ton of oxygen here.
Yeah, the air feels pretty thick. Yeah. So it was actually quite a bit tougher than we expected. Part of the problem was that we both got colds, and you can probably hear that in my voice. I'm still fighting mine. Scout's gotten better. But that the fact that you've got a cold and that you're up at really high elevations and you can hardly get any oxygen made it pretty tough. But the trail tread is just really tough. So I would say don't wait till you're 60 years old to do this. And if you're short, just realize that you're going to have lots of really tall... They have lots of steps.
Yeah.
And they're big rocky steps, and a lot of them are just really tall. I use my trekking poles continuously. And I think of myself as kind of a pretty tough bird, but this was pretty difficult. I don't expect we'll go back, but I'm really glad I did it, and I'm glad that it's now that I don't have to keep doing it.
I heard you guys have a new motto that came out of doing Chola Pass. Is that true?
Oh, yes. Go ahead, Barney.
So we do find ourselves many times doing something pretty tough, whether it's on a
Yeah, usually not for 20 days straight, though.
And we decided next time we look at each other, as we did a number of times since the Paul trip, and say, oh my gosh, what have we gotten ourselves into? This is hard. One of us, after saying, you know, this is really tough, is the next person is going to say, yes.
But it's not Chola Pass.
But it's not Chola Pass, yeah. Yeah. But I have with my own eyes seen Everest and seen Everest up close. I have stepped foot in Everest Base Camp, and I just love that.
Yeah.
I really do.
Yeah.
That's awesome. I mentioned that in, I think it'll be the past episode that we air this, Steve Shattuck, aka Twinkle, just sent us an update from his year off that he's doing with Grace and hiking with her, and he mentioned a lot of similar places. Is there a specific route that's more popular to do, or is it just you guys copied each other's travel itineraries? Is there a more popular route?
There is usually what's called the Everest Base Camp route. Uh-huh. So everybody fly into Lukla Airport, 9,000 feet. It's billed as the world's most dangerous airport. I didn't tell my parents that beforehand, but afterwards. And then you go through a lot of little Sherpa towns, Namche Bazaar, Pangboche, Loboche, Tame, and you end up at a...
Well, you don't go through Tame if you're doing the Everest Base
Camp. What's the highest one?
Gorakshep.
Gorakshep. 17,000 feet, and then from there you do a day hike to Everest Base Camp, and usually also to Kalapatar, which is higher than Everest Base Camp, over 18,000 feet,
and
then you come back. About 2 weeks.
Okay.
And if I had to do this over again, I'd probably do that rather than adding on Chola Pass.
Right. Chola Pass was, there's a route called the Three Passes route.
Yeah.
And Chola Pass is the middle of those three passes. So we went with a travel group, and this was the itinerary they had. They just added Chola Pass and then the Gokyo Valley coming back to give you different scenery and stuff. And it really was very gorgeous, that second part. But yeah, just up to Everest Base Camp and back is the most popular route.
Right, nice. So we usually have a habit of going through guests' like hiker resumes. Can you tell us how you both got into hiking and how you got to where you are today as such beloved names in the hiking community?
we met each other. I was 16 and he was 23, and we were both avid backpackers already. My brothers were in the Boy Scouts, and they got to go backpacking, which meant that I wanted to go backpacking. I finally got to when I was 15. So we actually went on our first backpack together before we really went on our first date.
If we ever had a first date.
Yeah. Anyway, so we did a lot of backpacking in Oregon when we lived there. We've been backpacking in the Sierra a lot. In 2003, when we had kids, We took our kids backpacking.
Our son was backpacking already 3 times before he turned age 1.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
It appalled his grandparents.
Yes.
Is this the son that just climbed El Cap?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. We couldn't do that once we had 2 kids. We couldn't go quite as often because carrying, you know, 2 young ones and stuff and all your stuff is more difficult. But once the youngest was able to hike on her own, we did hiking every summer with our kids, or backpacking every summer with our kids. And then in 2003, we decided to try this ultralight long distance stuff. And we did the John Muir Trail in just over 2 weeks and decided that this was pretty neat. So we started planning our PCT hike.
And during the summertime after 2003, if I hadn't seen Frodo for a while, I knew where she was. She was in the back room reading Lost and reading trail journals.
Yeah, mostly from the PCT. Yeah, so in 2007, we hiked the PCT together. That was my one through hike. I've done a lot of other hiking since then, but not through hikes, but Scouts carried on the through hiking tradition.
Yes, and we'll get to that in a moment. In my book talks, I put a picture up. A very scrawny 13-year-old. The last piece of clothing he has on is cotton. The backpack, of course, is a metal frame backpack, and there's no hip belt. And it's not just because he has no hips, but it's because they didn't have hip belts at the time. I didn't even top the scales at 80 pounds. My pack weighed 35. I was miserable. And when I came off that hike, I was in love. I'd always been the smallest in my class, and it was hard for a boy to be a smallest in class. But out here in nature, all that matters is I can put one foot in front of the other, and I can see stuff that all my classmates can't see.
Yeah.
And it was wonderful. So I like always saying the names Mr. Massey, Mr. Quinn, and Mr. Metcalf. Those are my Boy Scout leaders, and they taught me 2 things over those years. And I didn't realize how important they were until I was an adult. One was to really be at a home in the outdoors. You can pop me down anywhere, and I'm at home out there. I feel comfortable. I'm not scared of the dark. If it's raining, if it's hailing, if it's snowing, I know how to do stuff.
And even at Chola Pass.
What's that?
Even
at Chola Pass. And the second thing they taught me was to like myself, and that's no small thing. Yeah. So I continued backpacking on with you, my adults, and then I met this a young woman. The things that had to be in place for us at age 16 and 23 even to begin to look at each other.
Yeah, I was thinking, oops, maybe I shouldn't have said our ages.
You know, it's okay. At one time, you used to be sheepish about it, but it's the most important thing that's happened in my life. I hope yours, too.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You're listening to voices who have been 40 years married, and we still like each other.
Yeah, you can tell.
Yeah, which is really, really neat and really special. So we backpacked a lot, took our kids out. It was an important facet of our life and who we were. And somewhere in the late 1990s, we really started getting solid on we would like to do a long trail. And so this 2003 hike that Frodo just talked about, JMT, that was to see if we'd come off it still really wanting to do the PCT. And it was no small thing to get out there. Frodo basically, she was a second career high school science teacher, had to basically say, I'm doing this. Your choice is whether I come back or not. And me, I was I was managing partner of my law firm, but I basically took a couple years to carve out a deal where I had the right to take 6 months off, and it didn't matter what you said. And nice. So on a Thursday in 2007 in springtime, I turned over keys and checkbook to my younger partners, and I left on Monday, and I called them once a month.
That must have been nice.
It was nice. I trust them. I couldn't do anything out there, but the conversation was always the same. It was, hello, I'm having the time of my life. And they would proceed to tell me how utterly busy they were. And it wasn't about guilt. We were each the same where we were. So when we finished in 2007, most people long hike. In the last month or so, part of the conversation is, well, are you going to do another long hike? Mm-hmm. And you have to really want to do a long hike. You know that. And I did. And Frodo didn't.
No, I had always said the PCT would be my only through hike.
And I'm starting to get into my 60s, and I'm so lucky in my retirement. My challenge is saying no often enough. I have so much wonderful things on my plate. And Frodo, in 2014, started telling people,
go ahead.
Started telling people, Scout's doing the CDT in 2015. And I remain internally grateful that she started doing that. And people would want to chat with me about it. And I'm focused on my latest writing project or the article working on, and I basically say, Frodo is fully authorized to talk about it. And that's what she did. So we hosted hikers that season. And last hiker left the Friday before kickoff, back days of kickoff. And on Sunday at kickoff, we rode off to do the CDT.
Right.
And then about 6 months later, lo and behold, the same thing happened.
Yeah.
Frodo starts saying, Scout's doing the AT in 2017. She knew I really wanted to do it. That summer, I was 65, turning 66. And so I set out from not Katahdin, but the guy I started hiking with wrote and said, Scout. He was also, if there are things wrong with the universe, it was our fault, because you do either one.
Or three.
And we'd done two. So we had the right universe, Rolling Thunder and I. So Rolling Thunder writes a couple months before, he says, Scout, we've always started at the international border. We were going southbound. So let's start at the Canadian border.
Ooh.
So we did 145 miles on the international AT. We saw two hikers the entire time. And then we climbed at the backside of Katahdin, did the knife ridge. And then finally, we come across 20 people on top of Katahdin. In October 25th of last year, I finished the AT, donned one of these funny little paper hats that have all three trail symbols. And at Springer Mountain, I cried.
Aww. Yes, you did. There you go. In between all of that, we've done lots of other long hikes, mostly in the North Cascades and the Sierra. Yeah.
And we did Wales. We were some of the first people on the Wales Coast Path. Wales, which is a country, you're ever there, don't forget that. Wales is the only country in the world that has a path along their entire coast, 870 miles long. They opened it on May 5th, 2012. I pitched Backpacker to do an article on the opening, cherry-picked up 200-mile sections, one an old one and one a brand new one, and I was carrying a GPS, not for my own guidance, but to lay down a track, and I know your listeners can't see it, but here's where I do a straight line. I said, this is what my GPS tracks like, the straight line, and then it looks like a whole bunch of curly cues and stuff, and then it goes a straight line again. Because that happened a few times a day. You know, they had gaps in their trail signs. Thank you very much.
So, Scout, let's jump into the reasons you're in Colorado. You have a new book out called The Continental Divide Trail, Exploring America's Ridgeline Trail. Can you tell us a bit about the book?
Yes. Each of these three trails is so unique. And for the AT, the granddaddy or grandmother of all of them, people have done some real serious work on the history. Many books have been published. And in 2014, Rizzoli International, one of the North America's preeminent coffee table books, started a trail series. And they started with the AT. Brian King, who actually works full-time for the AT for 30 years, is their historian, among other things, wrote the text. And so next, they want to do a book on the PCT, naturally enough. And they turn to the PCTA. PCTA has on its staff Mark Larrabee, who, of all things, has a Pulitzer, 25-year journalist, and they engaged him to write that, 50,000 words. And at the time, I'd written maybe 25 articles for various publications on PCT history. New York Times called me the informal historian of trail. Backpacker Magazine called me a geek for trail history. I'm not sure which one I like better. Love it. And Mark gave me a phone call, says, I'm doing this, and about half of it's going to be PCT history. And I said, well, come on down. We'll spend a half day together. I'll open up all my, I'll show you exactly what I have, and it's all at your disposal. And he came down, spent a half day. I have a lot of material in PCT history. At that time, I'd have put 5 years to it.
Written lots of articles. Stories.
We had written lots of articles. And about 2 days later, after Mark came down, he called me and said, Barney, what would you think about co-authoring this book with me? And that's what we did. And we got to tell these wonderful creation stories of the PCT, stories but almost lost. There wasn't just a father of the PCT, there was actually a mother, and it was her idea that won't surprise a lot of you. And it was neat being able to tell these stories. So soon after I finished the text of the PCT book, I went and I hiked the CDT, and I started pitching Rizzoli. We got to do a CDT book as the next one in line. And they bit after a year. No one had done any serious work on CDT history.
Right.
No one. And I had a year from the time I signed the contract to when the manuscript was due. But what was happening in between? I signed a manuscript, and within a few short weeks, we're hosting 1,000 people at our house. Scout has no bandwidth between picking up people at the airport, cutting pineapple for breakfast, and making steel cutouts.
And so maybe we need to clarify a little bit why you're doing all that.
Ah, we haven't covered that aspect of her life. So Frodo and I, this last spring, as we had done for 13 springs before that, we host starting Pacific Crest Trail through hikers. So, well, that's nice. But the deal is, you come into San Diego, the trailhead is 60 miles further east, the public transportation, when it runs, and it only runs 5 days of the week, gets you out there in more than a half a day, doesn't get you out at the trailhead, but instead in an unsigned area, it's unclear where it is. And people used to call their day zero their worst day on the trail. So starting in 2006, we started hosting hikers. Great way to touch the trail. You know, these people who are starting, it's before we're going, at least spur our enthusiasm. And that year, we picked up at the airport or bus or train, 17 people total. And we thought we were hot.
Yeah, over a course of a couple of weeks.
Yeah. Next year, before we hiked, we hosted 35. And the year we came back, we hosted over 100. And the number's been going up ever since. And this last year, over 7 weeks, we had 1,100 people exactly stay at our house.
That's insane.
Yeah.
And this is, we accept no gifts, no donations. We do it because we can, because in 2007, when we first threw, like, you know this, we had so much kindness come our way, and it's a pleasure to get back, as well as we have 60 volunteers who help out with all this stuff.
Yeah. So, yeah, we had someone message on the Instagram for Backpacker Radio, and, you know, one of their questions to ask was, besides giving a donation, what else can I do?
Buy my book.
And yeah, buy his book. But that you guys prefer they donate to the PCTA,
yes,
if they stay with you,
right?
PCT.
And actually, what we really prefer, if I had one wish for this universe we live in, I wish there was more kindness.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that I feel we send out this insidious wave of kindness into the world.
Yeah.
Because we do ask people to kind of pay it forward.
Yeah, and they do. And I love it. We get stories in the future of how some little thing we've done at the house affects them, and it's just wonderful.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a good way to start. Like, having stayed with you guys myself, being able to get the after-dinner talk you give and kind of get prepped for what to expect on the trail and how to go about it is something that, you know, there's a lot of things that people wouldn't think about when they start a thru hike, and just having that as a reminder right before you're about to start is really helpful.
Oh, that's
always good to hear.
Yeah.
So I have this year to do this book manuscript, right?
Mm-hmm.
Plenty of time. Well, 2.5 months are taken up with hiker hosting.
Right.
5 days later that year, after the last hiker leaves, I go to hike the Appalachian Trail.
Uh-oh.
So that use another 5 months. I finished on October 25th, and I have 3.5 months to write a manuscript. It should take me a year. And literally within a few days.
And do all the research.
Yeah. Within a few days, we hop in the car in San Diego, drive to the divide. Frodo's driving most of the way. We put 5,000 miles down, do it. I'm doing 1 to 6 interviews a day. We're popping into archives. I don't work this way. My research trips are planned out weeks in advance. I know, you know, who I'm seeing. It's comfortable. I'm working at 24-hour notice. I'm calling people that I've just learned about that they had an important 1930s, their father or grandfather hiked the entire state of Colorado, first one to do it, and all these people who have real important stories. I'm calling 24 hours before. They were all making time. I had someone look at me when I'm telling the same story, and they said, these stories want to be told. So
that's
we
a great
do.
Way to put it.
Yeah, they really do. So on February 8th, I turned in a manuscript, that date was important because the day before our first grandson had been born.
Oh, congrats!
And the next morning, I was in a train from New York, having turned the manuscript in early train by 11 o'clock. I was holding our grandson.
who lives in the D.C. area?
He lives in D.C. area.
Yeah,
that must have been a great reward at the end.
Yeah.
It was a wonderful leaf in the heart. The Rizzoli had their layout woman since 7 solid weeks in the book. One of the things that people first asked me is, well, did you take all the pictures, all these photos yours? I felt real proud that I had 5 or 6 photos in the book.
Right.
For each of these books, we invited around 15 pros and semi-pros. Maybe a third of them I knew or to trail friends. But people who, when they hike the trail, they do some flipping just because the sunlight will be right.
Yeah.
And they'll have better sunlight for more of the day. For really devoted, and take some of the two-page spreads in the CDT book, I open it and I almost want to cry. You know, there shouldn't be things this beautiful, and it's wonderful that they are in this world and we're able to capture it. It's going to sit in people's coffee table books and open it. I like to say that people come for the pictures for these books, but they stay for the stories.
I was going to say, that's probably one of the most unique thing about these books compared to other books on the trail is there's those big pictures, there's those informative little stories. It's not just someone's memoir about it, but it's, you know, these incredible just documents of the trail.
I write because I like to move people. I like because I like to bring to light stories that wouldn't have come to light otherwise. If you don't laugh and if you don't cry after a few pages, then I completely failed.
How did you get into writing?
I was an avid reader growing up. There was a time, I think, when I said, if you gave me my ideal of heaven would be to live in a big library, every day be able to have fresh baked cookies and milk, and occasionally be able to let out and see my loved ones. That's not true, but I would say that. I used to think that books were magic. Writing stories that would carry the eye along were magic. How could people do that? And then just my first year after law school, I got my job was as a clerk in the courtroom. So I basically functioned as our courtroom didn't have an armed bailiff. Instead, they had me if someone got a hound, and that did happen at times. And I got to live in a courtroom for a year. And so much of courtroom life is not like on TV. It's boring. But one-twentieth of the time, it opens up and it is more dramatic than you see in TV. And it's almost like the roof opened up and you have this cosmic social issue four square right in front of you, and it's being debated. And I had a hard time telling friends about this. So one day, I took a notebook with blank pages and I started to write the next great American novel. 24/7, I'd look forward to the weekends so I could get up in the morning and work on it. I wrote a 250,000 word, which is equivalent probably of 600 page novel. And then I went and tried to get it published.
It's called Courtroom Number 9.
Courtroom Number 9. It's a good story. Good story. And what I got back from New York at the time, this is 1980, 1981, I got back, we're interested, good story, but it doesn't fit our list. Keep us in mind and send us your next. Never got a signed contract. I did start on the next. And then we, after 5 years married, have our first. I have an 8-month-old. We're living like church mice. Frodo was working on a PhD, and me, I hung up my law degree, and I'm bringing it next to nothing. And I go back to New York, and I wrangle some face-to-face meetings with frontline senior editors, three of them. And I remember the third woman, I'm sitting here in her office, and I'm looking around. This is early 80s, so there's nothing digital. And in her office are stacks of manila envelopes with manuscripts, stacks of them. And I sit there and realize I have a 9-month-old, a 9-month-old baby boy. His name is Sean. He's wonderful. He's 35 today.
No. And actually, he's 36.
He's 36 these days. Sorry, Sean. And I realized I have put my family through an awful lot, and I'm relying on someone like this woman, not just liking my work and not even loving my work. This woman has to love my work and feel it's going to personally get her ahead. And that's they decided it was time to move on. And I went back, had a 25-year... had a 25-year legal career in San Diego. And on the day I retired, a Friday, 8 years ago, my partner of 20-some years called and said, all right, Barney, that's my regular name, Barney, he spoke some words of wisdom that day. You know, what are you thinking today? And here's what I got to tell him. I got to tell him, today is my first deadline for Backpacker Magazine. 2:00, I have to push send on an email, and that's all I've been thinking about today.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
That's really nice. So were you a born natural, or did it take a while to hone in the skill? Because I read the introduction to Through Hike on your website, and it's really well written.
Thank you. You guys can't see, but that actually brings a tear to my eye. It is. I could not tell you how many times I've rewritten that.
Yeah,
and rewritten it and written it so it sings, so it hopefully sings to your heart, and it makes you want to read that next line. No one is a born natural writer.
Right.
every writer is hones and rehones and rehones their skills as they go along the years, as they get feedback. Every writer has their first reader that sits on their shoulder the entire time. Sometimes it's just a gentle person. In all honesty, mine is Frodo. And every writer has two things. One, it's the most rewarding thing they do in their life. And two, so often and more often than not, they are sweating blood. It is hard, hard work. Cholo Pass wasn't that hard.
Okay, well, I'm going to interject a little bit. I will say he is a natural storyteller.
Yeah.
So, for example, when we host hikers and they come to the house, we give them kind of an orientation. If Scout gives them the orientation, it takes half an hour. Now, I'm a scientist, and I'm succinct. If I give the orientation, it's like 10 minutes, because he's telling stories the whole time. So he is a natural storyteller, even if he feels like he's not necessarily a natural writer.
That's true. That's true. Currently, we're in Denver, Colorado, and we're in the middle of your book tour. You've so far gone up to Fort Collins, and you were in the tattered cover down the street earlier this week, and now you're about to head to Salida. How's all this?
Salida Mountain Sports, speaking of this afternoon, at Monday will be Boulder REI, and I just on Friday they had opened, they had 70 slots, they're all filled, and I called them up and said, okay, we'll go all the way to the fire maximum, we'll open up and have 80.
I registered, there's only 4 spots left.
Wow.
So you're almost full on that one.
On Tuesday at the Dillon REI, and then Wednesday at a bookstore, The Bookworm, which is right near Edwards and Vale. And then that's the end of my Colorado segment for the moment. I have Los Angeles and San Diego later in the month, and then one that really, I love them all, but in particular, lifelong dream of mine to speak at Powell's bookstore in Portland. Yeah.
Wow, that's incredible.
Their main store, their block of books, 4 stories tall. Mark Larrabee and I spoke at their for the PCT book. We had 250 people come. 70 or 80 of them stood the entire time.
That's amazing.
And I loved it. And I had 2 of the folks we covered in the book there. One of them was June Mulford, who was almost 90 at the time. She and her husband, 1959, first folks to through ride the trail. And during the 50s, they were one of the 2 events that kept the PCT spark barely alive. It was a dark time for trails there. And they did that, rode the entire trail on their horses, and everyone told them it couldn't be done. Came back. For 10 years, they showed movies of this, and then they disappeared, and no one knew about it. Remember the Wilderness Press guidebook? It used to be our Bible.
Yeah.
3 volumes, number of pages. In their 4-page history section, you can tell I felt it should be a lot longer. They said, to thru-ride the trail is much harder than to hike up. Well, yeah, you're supporting a 1,000-pound animal or two. And the first person to do it was Jim McRae in 1988. Not so. June had done it 59. When I found her, her husband was dead for 20 years. Reached her by phone in her early 80s. She had not talked about this in decades. She was cleaning house. And she said, yeah, I still have our original movie, 16 millimeter in the big fat can, and I'm getting ready to throw it out. So I was up there for a week. We saved her story. And in front of these 250 people, I told both her story and the importance of it and showed some of her pictures. And at the very end, I said, I've been standing up here on this platform telling you the story, but my heart's been here in the first row where Jew Mulford sits. And with her walker, she slowly gets up. And this crowd gives her the biggest ovation. It was wonderful.
That's
absolutely
amazing.
So Powell's is December 3rd, and maybe this plays before December 3rd. Please come out if you're in the Portland area.
Yeah, we'll post, if we'll get in touch with you and get an updated book schedule from you, and we'll post that in the show notes. So if you hear this and you want to check out Scout's book tour, check the show notes, and we'll post where he's going next, and it'll be accurate to when this is released.
Thank you very much. And by the way, you come, one of my talks, I will take you far away for an hour. And in these times, that's a blessed thing.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. What can someone expect if they're going to one of your talks?
Laugh and cry. I tell stories.
Yeah.
I do not. This is not a book reading. Don't come expect a book reading. To tell a story orally is very different than to tell in writing. Show about 60 images. You will see a 3-minute video. So if any of you have done a long hike, you know it's a mental game. You have to find things to pull you along. The mental side is every bit as important as your feet, every bit as important as your gear. And one of the things I did on my CDT hike to pull me along, I got this idea in my head. No one had done any of those cutesy videos, like a PCT guy takes a picture of his face every day, and then he does a 2-minute video of it. And they're sort of fun.
Yeah.
Or there's the happy dance, and every week or so she does, gets little friends, and they do the same tune, this little dance, and she puts together. It's a lot of fun. Well, what did I decide to do? Every day, I was going to look for the perfect background, sit down, take off my shoes and socks, and do a foot photo with the background.
Oh, that's a good idea.
And then put these in, you know, that string of the 150 photos, you know, in town. There'd be a pizza next to it, and do a snappy video. There's a guy many of you may know, Virgo, who's done some of the best on the PCT shorts and Trail Angel documentaries.
And he made the 2016 class video for the PCT.
Right.
Yeah, one of the most excellent.
Mm-hmm.
He did. Excellent. His day job. This is his day job.
Yeah.
The documentarian, videographer, film editor. I engaged him, and we, as a joint project, put this together. I got the last final cut about 10 days ago, and we showed it the first time in Port Collins.
Nice. See, that's funny that you thought to do that of your feet. I've always been so like envious of those photos of everyday pieced together, because I can't grow a beard.
And they
the best when someone's growing a beard in them, and they start clean-shaven, and at the end they've got this long beard. And I remember I wanted to do that when I started the PCT, and I was like, I'm going to look pretty similar at the end.
Yeah.
This isn't going to be as good. So
it was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
So please come out to any of my book talks. I'll give you a real good time.
And so what was the most challenging part of writing the book? Was it the fact that you had such a limited amount of time, or the deadline, or the lack of information?
The hardest part was organizing these 3 weeks so I could get everyone in I wanted to. I had a chance of finding everyone and getting as much of the source material and the visuals, as well as the heartfelt stories. That was the hardest thing. The actual writing is, I work backwards. You know, just getting through, like, okay, I want to be in Canada about this time, and then I work backwards to make sure I get there. And I had a February 8th due date, and I looked at it. I said, all right, I work backwards. This is how much I have to do a day. And I work 24/7 to do it.
Is it easier when you're... Sorry.
Okay, I was going to say, I'm going to interject and say, one of the hard things was tracking down the story of Peter Parsons, and I think that's worth telling.
You okay with that?
I'm fine with that.
Gosh,
Tell me a story.
So, many of you know, the first person to through hike the Appalachian Trail, Earl Schaffer, 1948. Okay. First person to hike the PCT, it's either a guy in 1952. We have some record of him. But most people would refer to Eric Ryback, 1970, came back and wrote that bestseller, 300,000 copies. How about the CDT, the wild child, the youngest one of the three, least marked, least hiked? Many would have said Eric Ryback, 1972, did it. There's a few others. There was a small group of five did in 77. First two women through hike to 1978. When you put out energy to the universe, it often comes back to you in nice ways. So when I was doing all the work on the PCT history, one of the places I found was a great repository, the Mazama's Outdoor Mountaineering Club in Portland, Oregon. They have this wonderful 5,000-volume library and archives of all the summit registers, and dating back to late 1800s. And for them to have someone come and not just check out a book or two, but be really enthused about the records. I made 5 separate research trips there and spent a day or two. I write articles about it. Someone is coming here and writing articles and telling us how enthused they are about it. And so these archivists, they start sharing with you their prizes. And one day Jeff Thomas came to me, and he spread out in front of me a 1924 summit register of Mount Jefferson. And he pointed to an entry, and I read it. Okay, Peter L. Parsons. And the guy talks about the route he goes up. He's a little chatty that morning. But his last two sentences were, and this entry was in August 1940, his last two sentences were, this is a continuation of a trip I began on April 12th at Douglas, Arizona, hiking the entire Rocky Mountain Divide up to Canada, and then I jumped over to Mount Rainier, and now I'm at Mount Jefferson. I think, you got to be kidding me. Someone hiked the entire divide in 1924? Well, this was about 5 years ago. I had lots of other things on my plate, made a record of it, filed it, and it was on the outer side of my plate. But when this book contract said, I have to find, get to the bottom of this. Did he actually do it? Are there any records of it? Are there newspaper articles? Peter Parsons is too common of a name.
Right.
There's even a number of Peter L. Parsons. There's even a number of Peter L. Parsons who lived around that time in Oregon. Actually enlisted the aid of a retired vice president of Qualcomm. He said, Scout, I hear you're doing this book, and I know you're pressed for time. Can I help in any way? And we looked, and we persevered, and we finally found an article, 1926, that we knew which Peter L. Parsons it was. It described briefly his hike in 24, described what he looked like. He was this mountain man extraordinaire. He carried a 60-pound pack, including a pistol and a rifle. He would shoot game along the way, and that would be more than half of his food supplies. And my gosh, he did it. We now know he lives in Mill City. And that he was an immigrant and jumped ship in 1909. That's how I came to BML City. And from there, so much is his perseverance and working on clues and just real this gumshoe work and dogged making for every 20 phone calls you make or leads you follow up, maybe one will pan out. And one of these 1 out of 20 panned out. Maybe this woman named Ursula Bassett appears to be the daughter of Pete Parsons' best friend. Ursula's now 90. And I call her. This is a few days before Christmas in 2015.
2016.
And I reach her, briefly explain my nature, and Ursula, 90, these are her first words back at me. She says, how many days do you have? Her father was Otto Witt, Pete Parsons' best friend. Otto Witt got married, had a family, had a daughter. Pete Parsons never got married. And he would work at the mill, build up a grubscape, give it to his best friend, Otto. And then he'd go off on his adventures, including hiking the entire divide. He kept a diary.
Oh, wow.
Otto Witt had it. When Otto Witt died at 96, it went to his daughter. His daughter, now 90, has it in the basement of her house.
What are the chances that you found his friend's daughter and she had his journal? That's insane.
Pete Parsons carried a Kodak accordion expandable camera on his hip. He took 2-inch by 3-inch negatives, which he would dutifully send back to his friend Otto. He had 300 from this trip. She still had them.
So when you're getting this book, you're not just getting a picture book about the Continental Divide Trail. You're getting information that has never really been told or, you know, even processed through fully.
And so many stories, this was the case. So Parsons, one of the first photos, because we have to take these slides and then get them scanned, professionally scanned and cleaned a little bit. The first photos that I had that done to, he's in northern Colorado at Fall Creek Pass. It's him next to a sign with his backpack on the ground. And on the back of his backpack, in 3-inch letters, he has had printed out, and it says, you just love this stuff. It says, heading north, Mexico to Canada.
Oh,
give me a break. So how did he take the selfie?
Yeah.
He's another, excuse me.
Wait a minute.
How did he do this? There was a hint in that photo. One of his hands is pursed a little bit, and in every photo of himself, you see the same thing. And a photo from the year before, we caught in the action. So it's an accordion canner. It pulls out, and it's got a shutter in the front. You can push straight up and down. It also has a forward-facing shutter. And what he would do is he would tie, he'd lock the camera in on where he's going to be. And he'd set on the ground or a rock, whatever it is. So, and then tie the string, the forward-facing shutter, at 20, 30 feet, and then he'd pull it and drop the string.
So this might be one of the first selfies.
Yeah.
And one of the photos, we actually caught him in the act. The string hadn't dropped yet in time.
Oh, and you were right.
And that photo's in the book. But his story... We have detail. he's a detailed writer, so he'd talk about, oh, I saw Mama Grouse and her chicks today, and they were so cute. And then his entry that night is, she would have gone really good with my beans. He gets to a river, northern Colorado, gets to a river, and goes a mile one way, not the other way. There's just no crossing it. It's too high, too fast. So what does he do?
I don't know.
He builds himself a raft.
Oh.
And then as he's going across, he realizes, this stream, this river is actually going the direction I want to go. So why don't I go on my raft a couple, you know, five, six, you know, a day, day and a half now.
Yeah,
and then
work.
I'll get off and hike north. I'll hike north.
Wow.
A great photo of him at the northern border monument. He writes, I've actually read his journals. He started journaling in 1914, and I've read them all the way through to when he died. In only one, he never married, and only one does he write about a woman, and that was on this CDT, this Continental Divide hike. In Wyoming, he's pulled off to a small town to resupply. He's sitting at a coffee counter, and a woman sits down next to him. This is 1924. This woman is riding cross-country on her motorcycle. And he proceeds to describe her. She's got red cheeks, and he's never met anyone that just such an adventurer like he does. And his final line was, because he's writing it after they've parted, his final line was, I can kick myself for an ass that I didn't get an address or phone number.
Oh.
Pete Parsons died in 1931. We actually had the last letter he wrote to his friend Otto Witt. Dear friend Otto, at the very end, he has now decided to continue his hike all the way to the Arctic Ocean, go up the Rockies, and he switched 1,000 miles north of the Canadian border. He switched to a canoe, and he loves the little canoe, and he writes to dear friend Otto, I just covered 550 miles in 3 weeks, and there were these rapids. They said no one has run, and I ran 14 miles, and then I decided at Portage last seven, and that's who he was. And I'm now heading off to the Arctic Ocean. I have $700 in the Royal Canadian Bank. Here's the number in case you don't hear from me and something happens. And then he asks Otto, if you hurry up and write back, it might get me at the next stop fort. I forget what the Canadian fort was. Otto wasn't able to catch up with the letter. And the next contact Otto has is from the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. That they had found Parsons' body with his address on it.
Tell them where they found it.
They found it right below the Rapids of the Drowned, just above the Great Slave Lake, which was another 800 miles on his journey.
Wow. I was going to say, when you mentioned the Colorado part, that's bold to build yourself a little raft, given how crazy the rivers can be.
That's what he would do. That's who he was. He died at age 41. And Otto would tell Ursula, who was 3 years old when Pete died, Otto would tell Ursula always throughout his life about his good friend Pete.
Yeah.
Peter, and he'd finish it the same way. He would say, Pete would have hated growing old. The story doesn't end there. 1932, two up in the Canadian Rockies, two skiers, intrepid skiers, are out to set a first record. They are going to be the first to do a winter ascent on skis of a major rocky peak. It's in the Mount Robeson area. They're going to climb Mount Resplend. There's a cabin near the base of Mount Resplendent. They're going to stage in first, abandoned cabin. They go there, go in the cabin, and they find an inscription on the wall, carved in the wall, and it's February 1930, and it begins, let it be recorded that I, Peter Parsons, today, skied up the top of Mount Resplendent and back. I believe this is the first ascent. And so there's your Peter Parsons story.
That's amazing.
To be able to tell it.
Even like the fact that, I mean, when you're hiking one of the long trails, you come across the trail registers, and I always just jot down something stupid like my name and having fun or, just something to just mark down my name. That way if something happens, that's there. But the fact that, you put the people that do put a little bit of info, how valuable that can be in the future, how would he have known?
Yeah.
It's incredible. Well, that's actually a pretty good example of what people can probably expect at your book talks, right? Stories like that?
Stories that they'll be able to see the picture of that.
Yeah.
This afternoon at Slide Mountain Sports, I guess I told you earlier, we'll have the son and grandson of two folks who hiked in the 1930s.
Oh, wow.
The entire state of Colorado.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
All right, well, Apart from the bookstore, apart from the book tour, what's next for you guys? Do you have any other big plans, or is it?
Well, in addition to writing about the trail, and in addition to our trail angeling, there's another large facet of trail life for me. I served 9 years on the PCTA board and 3 years as board chair. Privilege and honor during that time with a lot of others, including the great executive director, Liz Bergeron, great PCTA staff and great board members. We took the PCTA from an organization with $1 million budget to just over $3.5 million.
Oh, wow.
And this is emblematic of the great work that we can do on the ground and trail. So I termed out 2 years ago, and now I'm on the board of the Continental Divide Trail Coalition. I'm actually vice president, and our president has just had twins and informed us that that's going to take first priority, so there's some writing on the wall there.
Ooh. And I don't know if we've mentioned this, but the proceeds of the Pacific Crest Trail book and the proceeds of the Continental Divide Trail book both go not to you, but to the PCTA and to the CDTC.
Exactly.
So when you're buying one of these books, you're supporting those organizations.
Yes.
That's incredible.
And I'm also on the board of the Partnership for the National Trail System, an organization most people have not heard of, but there is an umbrella organization for all the 30 congressionally designated national scenic and historic trails. The board of that, and there's some writing on the wall there, but I'm not privy to be able to say that, too.
But anyway, as far as hiking and stuff like that, I do still have a bucket list.
Ooh, what's on it?
We've never been to the Alps, so we do plan on going to the Alps, and hopefully that'll happen next summer. And then the next thing on the list is Patagonia, so we're hoping to do that in the winter of 2020.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah.
Those will both be incredible.
Yeah, I figure we need to get some of these done before we get too old.
And I do have a few other items after we get Frodo's bucket list done. The INT really interests me.
Which one is that?
The Israel National
Trail. Israel National Trail, 600 miles from the from the Lebanon border down to the tip of Negev. And a little bit lately, I've gotten interested in the Arizona Trail. That's intrigued me.
Oh, man.
Is this your first time hearing that?
Yep.
Well, that's great. Last question. Frodo, can we expect any books from you?
Oh, no. No, I let him do that.
Okay.
You could write a good one. My Life with Scout.
Yeah, that's true.
A memoir.
That's true. And we do actually, you know, from hosting hikers and stuff, we get lots of stories from that. Yeah, we get to hang out with really cool people.
Yeah. Well,
can I do two shout-outs?
Yeah, definitely.
First of one is to our good friend and trail wonder, Heather Anderson, who has just completed a calendar year Triple Crown.
We had her on one of the episodes. It hasn't aired yet, but when this is out, it will have aired.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
Congratulations, Heather. First woman to do a calendar year Triple Crown. She now has done a triple. She has hiked all three trails three times. First woman to do that, too. Good friend, great role model. Congratulations, Heather. And then the second shout-out is going to be a little bit different one. Shout-outs to Alvin Whitehair. Alvin Whitehair is a district ranger, Grants, New Mexico, the first Native American district ranger. Alvin Whitehair is responsible for the Forest Service for an area the size of a small state.
Oh, wow.
This man is full-blooded Navajo. He was, I interviewed in the book, his story's in the book. I sat there. He came out on a federal holiday. He drove, I think, more than an hour to be there. He was happy to be there. And this man had inherited a district where the history was the Forest Service made the rules and the towns around it, they danced to it. And they liked it or they didn't. And he came in and said, this is not the way we do it. We work as a partner. We listen. And this is all of ours. And he did a complete turnaround. And this is a man who was one of the last of the generation who were forced to go to the boarding schools, where he said they would make us take 20-minute showers to wash the Navajo out of us. We were forbidden to speak Navajo language. We'd have to go off in the bushes. And this is a guy who sits there peacefully and tells a story, and then he gets a smiley face because he talks about how he has a radio call-in talk show. I forget the radio station, but it's all Navajo all the time. They wash nothing out of him.
Yeah.
And here he is, they're proud of his heritage, doing this responsible for land larger than a small state, And I just love that. And he listens religiously to this podcast.
Does he?
Yes, he does.
Oh my God,
which is wonderful. Alvin, it's great to have you along.
Yeah, that's an incredible story. Is that, now that you've mentioned that, is there anything else you'd like to plug? Your website, any places that people can find your work?
I've had plenty of opportunity to do that. I do have a tagline, though.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, and something I often say at our after-dinner talks, that one of the things I love about Long Trails was that this was a community I always wanted to be with, but I never knew existed.
It's a great tagline. Well, yeah. Thanks so much, guys, for both coming on. Appreciate having you and you guys taking time out of the busy book tour to sit down for an hour. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for chatting with
us. Yeah. And we'll put all the links to this stuff in the show notes, and I'll plug your website for you if you won't. It's Barney Scoutman?
BarneyScoutman.com.
And he's got his trail journals there, which are incredibly detailed and really well written. You can read the intro to his book, Through Hike. You can get information on the Pacific Crest Trail book and kind of just see the other works that he's written. So you should head there and go to one of his book tours.
Look forward to seeing you out there. It's a real pleasure.
And that was that. Chance, you did a really good job. I'm very proud of you. Okay, so let's get to the Trek propaganda portion of today's show. In the previous episode, we talked about the top footwear as a result of the AT Thru-Hiker survey. Today, I want to talk about the top shelters. Before we get to the breakdown of the most popular brands and models, just a couple fun facts to drop in on you is that nearly 81% of people use primarily tents as their preferred shelter choice on the AT. And 100% of people that hiked with a dog did use a tent. Probably makes sense because it wouldn't work too well with a hammock, or I suppose if you, there weren't too many tarp users, so that's not surprising. But of the people that hiked solo, so not in a couple or didn't have a dog, 43% of those hikers use a one-person tent, whereas 55% use a two-person tent.
Really?
Yeah.
Why?
That's a very good question. I don't know if that was answered in this or if that was a question asked in the survey. I'd have to go comb through again. Is your question that you're surprised that there's that many two-person tents for solo hikers?
Yeah.
I think it's that AT hikers tend to be, you know, newer hikers and they're less weight conscious. I think they would rather have the luxury of the extra space. Again, I'm just guessing. I carried a very, very heavy one-person tent on my through hike, so I don't apply, but it was heavier than most of the two-person tents that are highlighted in this list below. Yeah, that would probably be my guess, but that's just speculation, so don't take that as fact.
Interesting.
Let's start with the most popular brands of shelters on the AT, and this one will come as no surprise. They've been number one for each year that we've done this, and that is Big Agnes. They make a plethora of very thru-hiker-centric freestanding tents or semi-freestanding tents, depending on how gear nerdy you want to get about it. Number two, and I think this is the first time they've been number two on this list, so kudos to them, is Z-Packs, and they actually have the most popular two-person model. We'll get to that in a second. And number three is Nemo. Nemo makes very good tents as well. I have their, the Hornet one-person, which I really like.
I have one of Nemo's two-people tents. I don't know which one it is, though.
Yeah.
It's green.
Yeah.
Not that that helps.
Their tents are really similar to Big Agnes. Mm-hmm. I assume that they're using those as a gauge for how to make their tents, which is a good brand to use as your base, I would say.
Yeah.
So that probably the information that's most useful to you guys are what tents in particular people are using. I'm going to break this down into two categories, the most popular one-person tent and the most popular two-person tents. Do you have any rough guidance on if you had a friend that was about to embark on a thru hike, if you were going to tell them to take a one person or two person tent?
It depends on how much space you like to have. If you know you want to spread out and you know you want extra room, then maybe a two person. But I just can't imagine wanting to carry more than a one person tent because you don't even have that much stuff.
Yeah. I'm trying to like transport back to prior to my first thru hike AT 2011 drink. And I think the idea of being enclosed in a coffin is probably the way I would picture a one person tent.
Right.
Seems slightly claustrophobic. Fast forward to 5,000-6,000 miles later, and I'm definitely a one one person tent sort of guy. But I understand people's, you know, fears going into something like this and why they'd want the extra space. I will say that most of these tents have vestibules big enough that you could put your gear between the tent and on the inside of the vestibule. So if that's the primary concern, maybe that's something to consider. You know, I think just the psychological comfort of people having the added space is probably why they want the two-person tent. But, you know, this is a good reason to go out on a shakedown hike, is to find where your comforts lie. But yeah, I agree with Chance. I think that a one-person tent is probably plenty for most people. Although I will say the one-person tent that you used is huge.
I was going to say, I kind of went the opposite of what you did, because yeah. I got a one-person tent and tried to put two people in it.
Yeah.
I was like, this will be big enough.
it honestly is probably close to the same size as some of like the popular freestanding two-person tents. It's a yeah. big tent.
I guess it just depends on what kind of one-person tent you'd be getting.
Right. So I use the Solplex, which is not one of the three most popular, which we're about to get to. But I mean, it's tight. Like, you don't have a lot of room on either side. I think if you were, you know, 6'2", 6'3", and above, it probably wouldn't be long enough for you. I'm speculating. Again, I'm 5'11", so that doesn't apply to me. But, you know, there's a lot of different variables that go into this. But I think for most people that are trying to shave weight, they can probably comfortably... it would take an acclimation period, but they would be comfortable in a one-person tent after some time. And I think, in my opinion, it's worth the extra weight savings. But again, your mileage might vary. Yeah. So without further ado, the most popular one-person tent was the Big Agnes Fly Creek HVUL1. I think the HV is new this year. It used to just be the non-HV version. I think HV stands for like high volume, where they raise the ceiling. So it just provides more interior right. space, basically.
Okay.
More headroom. The second most popular was the REI Quarter Dome. I never used it, but I've heard good things, and I think it's a pretty affordable tent. And then the last on this list is it's the Six Moons Designs Lunar Solo. And for the popular two-person tents in order, the number one is the Z-Pax Duplex. This is the two-person tent version of the tent that I used on the PCT. And I can see why it's popular. I don't have the specs offhand, but it's very light. This is a Cuban fiber tent, Dyneema. Easy to set up, durable, mostly good things to say about it. The number two on this list is the Big Agnes Fly Creek UL2. So basically the two-person version of the same tent is the most popular one-person tent. And then the third most popular is the Big Agnes Copper Spur UL2. The Copper Spur seems to be fading a little bit in popularity. I remember, I think it used to be the most popular two-person tent. I could be wrong. Fact check me on that. But I think the reason for that is earlier this year, Big Agnes released a new tent, which did not crack this list. I was actually a little bit surprised, and that might have to do with the timing of when it was released. But they released a tent called the Tiger Wall.
Yeah.
Which basically combines the best elements of the Fly Creek and the Copper Spur. So the thing that people don't like about the Fly Creek is that the door is at the head, mm-hmm. which makes it kind of awkward to get in and out of. I have the Fly Creek, and I agree that it is awkward. You get used to it eventually, like anything else. But, you know, now that I've also used the Tiger Wall, I will say the side entry is much preferred. But so it combines the side entry aspect of the Copper Spur, but the weight savings advantage of the Fly Creek. So it is still a little bit heavier than the Fly Creek UL2, but it has that feature with the side entry of the Copper Spur. So I could definitely foresee the Tiger Wall easily overtaking the Copper Spur for next year's survey, and quite possibly even the Fly Creek, depending on, you know, how weight conscious people are and how big of a deal the side door is for people. But yeah, so that's the wrap up for the most popular shelters. As always, I definitely encourage you to check out the original article written by Mariposa, who is brilliant. She asks a lot of questions that I wouldn't think to ask, and she is able to draw some very interesting correlations between these questions. For the last segment of the show, we're in the midst of holiday season, and the thing that sparked this was there was the internet holiday was International Mountain Day, which I don't even know what that means.
Oh, yeah, you messaged me about that.
Yeah. I don't know International Mountain Day.
The mountains probably know.
I mean, sure.
They're probably all partying.
But so I guess I don't understand. Are these holidays intended for only Americans, and we're supposed to appreciate mountains that are international, or?
Oh, that's a good question.
Yeah. So
which mountains do we appreciate?
I just assume everything on the internet should be an international something or other, which is part of the confusion. The other thing is, I don't know why you have to pick a favorite mountain. I think my favorite mountain is pretty much whatever one I'm on at the time.
Was it Favorite Mountain Day or was it Appreciate Mountain Day?
It was, again, whatever December 11th was, you guys can look into it. I think it was International Mountain Day.
So which mountain did you pick?
Well, I didn't truly understand the question and I didn't look into it. But if I had to pick a mountain, I would pick Mountain Dew.
Ooh, okay.
Code that Red sounds, specifically.
That sounds rehearsed.
Actually not rehearsed at all. I'm volleying back to you. What's your favorite international mountain?
I don't know.
Stumped you with that Code Red, didn't I?
I know, now I can't think straight. I can't think of mountain names.
Yeah, you can't just give a regular mountain after a Mountain Dew you like that. So
exactly. A Mountain Dew me like that.
That was an accident, but all right. So the moral of the story is we're going to do our favorite, quote unquote, forgotten internet holidays.
Yeah.
And you guys can be the judges as to whether these are real or otherwise.
Yeah.
Chance, I think I have more than you do, so I'll go first.
How okay, you go first.
So January 8th, so right around the corner, really.
Okay.
Is National Double Chin Day.
Ooh.
I feel like we appreciate our first chin a little bit too much, but it's the second one that is kind of the, it's like the middle child, if you would, of chins.
Right, so underappreciated.
Very underappreciated.
Okay, well then I'll jump, you said that was January 8th?
Yep.
I'll jump 4 days ahead of you. Get ready for January 12th when we have National Kiss a Ginger Day.
Kiss a Ginger. Oh, I like the way that you played right into our own strengths on that one.
Yeah.
That's good.
Oh, yeah.
And my wife will be very bummed to learn about that holiday.
I know. It'll be a Void Zach Day in Zachary household.
Exactly. And I'll jump forward a little bit further from there all the way into February, which is February 10th. I don't know if you know this, but it's actually Selfie Next to a Toilet Day. You're in for a treat with that one.
That's fun. I just read this one. I actually wasn't laughing at your joke. I'm laughing at what I just read. So my birthday's on Pi Day, and I was
314.
Yeah, I wasn't gonna say Pi Day though because I don't really like pie too
what?
Much.
Wait a second. You don't like pie?
It's just, I don't know. It's okay.
Are you not a dessert person?
Oh, I'm a dessert person. Just pie is not my go-to dessert of choice.
There's so many different kinds of pie though. Like, you're telling me like a slice of warm apple pie with a la mode vanilla ice cream on top, that doesn't float your boat?
I like apple pie and I like pumpkin pie.
Sure. Okay.
And I don't really care for other types.
Banana cream? Mm. Oof. Pecan? Jesus. All right. Go ahead.
Anyway, so Pie Day is underappreciated, but I've just noticed on this list I pulled up on my phone, right underneath Pie Day, also on March 14th, which is my birthday, Steak and BJ Day.
Oh, I've actually... So
have you heard of that?
Yeah. I'm familiar.
I've never heard of that.
It's supposed to be a retaliation of sorts for Valentine's Day. So I think it's 1 month after Valentine's Day. So Valentine's Day is a holiday curtailed toward females, generally speaking.
Right.
I think if you ask most guys, they'd be happy to not celebrate it. But we do to please our women.
Uh-huh.
Fast forward a month. And if we had our version of Valentine's Day, as they would argue, that's probably the... two ingredients they would appreciate most.
That's so funny.
Yeah.
Okay, well, that's on my birthday, so I'll have to look forward to that.
I'm going to backtrack a little bit on the calendar here and remind you guys that on March 9th, it's International Flirtini Day.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Is that a type of drink or is that just you flirting with a little sass?
No, it's a drink.
Oh,
it's definitely a fancy cocktail. I don't know what's in it, but I know that it's internationally appreciated on March 9th.
Okay, so then you have to go March 9th and order one from a bar.
Yep, and post it on Instagram.
Yes.
And be sure to hashtag Backpacker Radio or just tag us. What are the kids doing these days?
Tag us somehow.
Cool.
Let us know. We're going to jump ahead to Friday, April 20th, a.k.a. 420, whose holiday on this list I've pulled up is... Lima Bean Respect Day.
Yeah, obviously.
Respect the lima beans.
When it's 420, that's the thing that I think most people are...
That's where people's minds go first, too.
They go straight to the lima bean.
Straight to the lima bean cabinet and show some respect.
It's all about that fiber. You got to have strong bowel movements, especially for Selfie Next to a Toilet Day on February 10th. So that was April 20th, you said?
Yes.
Again, I'm going to backtrack a little bit here on the calendar and remind you all listening to this that April 8th is Steal a Dollar from Your Friend Day.
Ooh.
And when you do this and you post the dollar that you've stolen from your friend, be sure to tag them TFF, Theft Friend Forever.
Theft Friend Forever. Okay. Yep. When you are done stealing your friend's dollar, Saturday, October 13th. It's a far time away, but when the day comes, National No Bra Day.
I would like to go out on the record and say I've been celebrating mostly since 1985.
Wow.
Yeah.
How'd you get away from it for so long?
You know, I'm just kind of a free spirit. I don't really care the rules that society tries to place on me, so...
Right.
Yeah. You know, I'm not trying to say that I'm better than
Zach
other
Davis,
people in the room.
Better than bras.
But hey, it's true. You were about to make a comment.
That's like I'm celebrating too.
Yeah, it's Wednesday here. It's in the middle of the week.
It's a crazy Wednesday here in Golden, Colorado. If we can give them one to look forward to in the near future, January 4th, National Spaghetti Day.
Ooh, all right.
It's one everyone can agree on.
Got a carbo load for that marathon that you're running in June, probably. Sometime.
After you set all those new resolutions.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All good resolutions entail you eating a giant plate of spaghetti within 2 weeks, I think.
I think so. It's like binding.
Yeah. So June 4th, we're jumping all the way to the summer now. So we've talked about this on the show before, but June 21st, summer solstice. Right. I think it might fluctuate by a day in some years, but is Hike Naked Day.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like we're not appreciating the potential for June 4th, which is International Cross-Dress on Trail Day.
Oh.
Yeah.
I feel like that's every day on trail, though, kind of sometimes. I hiked with four guys that wore four pairs of girl shorts.
Yeah, but did they wear dresses?
Shorts weren't good enough?
No.
Oh, okay.
So the line between guys' shorts and girl shorts, as someone that has his fair collection of 5-inch inseam shorts... It's a very thin line. I think maybe color and the cut is slightly different, sure.
They were awfully short.
You're getting more of a show than you were asking for, is what you're saying.
100%. On February 20th is National Love Your Pet Day, in case you forgot to do that the other 364 days.
I was going
to
say, I love the number of like pet and dog appreciation days in this list.
Like, you know what we haven't done enough this year? Appreciate our pets.
And this was not even planned, but I went for a hike with Sierra today in Boulder, and I posted on Instagram a picture of me.
Oh,
and her.
I saw that. I vomited a bit.
Yeah, that's the only selfies I do is when my dog can disguise half of my face. So let's fast forward to September now, September 15th, and this is very apropos based on our conversation. September 15th is National Let Your Dog Lick Your Open Mouth Day.
Ew.
Yeah.
Ew, I don't like that.
Well, you didn't even ask what it is.
You let your dog lick your open mouth.
Oh, yeah, you get it then.
Yeah, it's, how did I not get that?
just checking to make sure you're paying attention.
I laughed again because I'm scrolling back up the list, and this next one is April 14th.
Okay.
So we
Chance
did,
is jumping all over the calendar now.
Well, now yours makes sense because we did February 14th is Valentine's Day.
Yeah.
March 14th, I guess the boys got retaliation with Steak and BJ Day.
Correct.
But now April 14th says it's Cake and Cunnilingus Day.
So the girls get two. All right. You guys just can't.
We couldn't let you have it, could we?
No. Even wasn't good enough for you. You've always got to one-up us.
And there's nothing on May 15th yet on this list. So there's a chance to come back, but... Or sorry, May 14th.
And this is my last one. And this is definitely, I think, a holiday that you guys are all aware of. But on November 17th is World Danny DeVito Appreciation Day.
Oh, yeah. I've had that one marked down for months.
Yeah. Danny DeVito, what a guy.
Appreciate him.
How could you not?
You just couldn't.
Anywhere that you are in the world, let that appreciation show.
Should we take a moment of appreciation for Danny DeVito?
Okay. Well, I'll insert a Danny DeVito clip here now.
Okay.
Bang me, eat me, grind me up into little pieces, throw me in a river. Who gives a shit? You're dead, you're dead.
Terrific. So that's it for forgotten internet holidays. If there are any forgotten internet holidays that we forgot that you guys want us to know about, definitely hit us up at podcast@thetrek.co. And to Chance's favorite part of the show is the 5-star Ooh. iTunes reviews. I've got it on my phone.
Yeah, I don't have them.
There you go.
Okay. Feels Like You Are on the Trail by Bark Bomb. The Trail Correspondent series quickly became my favorite podcast this summer and fall. I would save the episodes until I could go on a long walk and daydream about being on a long walk. I'm looking forward to listening while I'm hiking the PCT next year. Zach and Chance are great, too. Needs more poop stories, though.
I agree.
No, it does not.
Well said.
Too many.
Do we have a podcast coming up that will be divisible by two? Because I think that's where it's appropriate to...
This one. Every other podcast is divisible by two.
Are you trying to tell me that every even number is divisible by two?
I don't want to blow your mind on
Listen,
this,
Chance was a math major back in the day, so...
No.
She's trying to explode brains over here with her knowledge bombs.
I know. I'll take it back. I'm being too smart for you. It's okay. Yeah.
So that concludes today's show. If you want to get in touch with us, you can follow us on Instagram at Backpacker Radio on Instagram, at Backpacker Pod on Twitter, facebook.com/Backpacker Radio. You can follow Chance at...
On Instagram at Juliana_Chauncey, on YouTube at Juliana Chauncey, and on Facebook at Chance Hikes.
You can find me at and that's it for today's show. Thank you so much.
Go watch Scout's Book Tour.
Happy hiking.
Bye.
Oh, botched toe. I botched that one. Oh, that's a botched job. Oh. That's bleeding. I need some trash to plug up the cut. Every time.